Broadcasting.
Thank you. Welcome, everyone. I will call the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee to order. This is the time in the session when things are constantly changing, so our agenda is no exception. The work sessions that we have on the schedule today, just so those who are watching can be aware, House Bill 2457 will be put over till Monday, and Senate Bill 139 will not be worked today. However, we will have some information to convey on that. Senate Bill 864 will be held over till Monday. And I think that's it, Chris, right?
Correct, Madam Chair.
Okay. All right. Let's start by taking the roll.
Senator Finley.
Senator Finley, present by video.
Senator Riley.
Present by video.
Senator Wagner.
Wagner's present by video.
Vice Chair Boquist.
Boquist on audio.
Madam Chair Burdick.
Present by video. Okay, we will start by opening a work session on House Bill 2446.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, House Bill 2446 would extend the sunset from 2022 to June 30th, 2028 for the property tax exemption available for low-income housing that's owned by nonprofits.
Okay. Senator Boquist, do you have a motion?
Yes, ma'am. I move House Bill 2446 to the floor with a due process recommendation.
Senator Boquist has moved House Bill 2446 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Okay, please take the roll.
Senator Finley.
Finley votes aye.
Senator Riley.
Votes aye.
Senator Wagner.
Wagner votes aye.
Vice Chair Boquist.
Boquist votes aye.
Madam Chair Burdick.
Burdick votes aye. The bill passes, and Senator Riley, would you be willing to carry this?
Of course, Madam Chair.
Okay, now we will open a work session on House Bill 2008.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2008B provides a tax exemption for property of religious organizations, also used for affordable housing, for low-income housing. This one is conditional on a 60-year affordability covenant.
Okay. Senator Boquist, do you have a motion?
Yes, ma'am. I move House Bill 2008B to the floor with a due pass.
Senator Boquist has moved House Bill 2008B to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? I see no discussion, so please take the roll.
Senator Finley.
Finley votes aye.
Senator Riley.
Votes aye.
Senator Wagner.
Wagner votes aye.
Vice Chair Boquist.
Boquist votes no.
Madam Chair Burdick.
Burdick votes aye. Thank you for making the motion, Senator Boquist. I will carry House Bill 2008. Okay, now we will open a work session on Senate Bill 464.
Madam Chair Burdick, members of the committee, Senate Bill 464 with the dash 5 allows for cancellation of 5/6 of the imposed property taxes upon such ordinance adopted by the governing body of the county. These are for properties that are specifically affected by the 2020 wildfires, and the governing body would adopt an ordinance that would draw a map for properties that were either affected to their real market value or there was a service interruption. There's no direct impact because this is a permissive measure. The counties have come back with an estimate of approximately a little under $5 million for potential revenue loss, but this is contingent on the adoption of the ordinance by the local government.
Okay, Senator Boquist.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move the A5 amendment dated whatever it says on OLIS into the main bill, which is Senate Bill 464.
Senator Boquist has moved the -5 amendment to Senate Bill 464. Is there discussion? I see no discussion, so please take the roll.
Senator Finley.
Finley votes aye.
Senator Riley.
Votes aye.
Senator Wagner.
Wagner votes aye.
Vice Chair Boquist.
Boquist votes aye.
Madam Chair Burdick.
Burdick votes aye. And Senator Boquist, would you be willing to carry this?
We need to adopt the bill, ma'am.
Oh, sorry about that. I'm getting ahead of myself.
Madam Chair, that's right, Madam Chair. I move SB 464 as amended by the A5 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Boquist has moved Senate Bill 464 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? I see no discussion, so please take the roll.
Senator Finley.
Senator Finley votes aye.
Senator Riley.
Votes aye.
Senator Wagner.
Wagner votes aye.
Vice Chair Boquist.
Boquist votes aye.
Madam Chair Burdick.
Burdick votes aye. Now, would you be willing to carry it, Senator Boquist?
Yes, ma'am. It's Senator Gerard's bill. If he does not want to carry it, I will carry it on the floor. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Okay. Now we will start with our public hearings. And the one that we have all the witnesses is 2247. Is that correct?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Okay, we will open a public hearing on House Bill 2247.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2247A would authorize the county to adopt an ordinance, so again, it's permissive, a resolution authorizing the waiver of an interest charge on delinquent business real property taxes for business property owners who are current as of February 15, 2020. That date reflects that the delinquency was also due to the situation around the pandemic and the wildfires.
Okay, we have Representative Boshert Davis with us, so we will start out with you.
Thank you, Chair Burdick. Chair Burdick, Vice Chair Boquist, members of the committee. My name is Shelley Bossart Davis. I'm the state representative from District 15. I introduce House Bill 2247 at the request of my Linn County Board of Commissioners as a response to what we're seeing on the ground in Linn County. House Bill 2247 allows the County Commission to adopt an ordinance to waive interest and penalties on delinquent property taxes if it can be shown that delinquent property taxes are substantially due to the effects of the COVID pandemic or 2020 wildfires. While HB 2247 was in the House Committee on Wildfire Recovery, we convened a technical work group based on feedback of the committee and stakeholders. The work group was able to fine-tune an amendment that still accomplishes what my county commission intended. I'm happy to say we were successful in getting the -1 amendment adopted, and House Bill 2247A passed out of the House Special Committee on Wildfire Recovery, out of the House Committee on Revenue, and passed through the House floor all unanimously. If it pleases the chair, J.L. Wilson should be on to discuss the policy in more detail whenever he's called upon. Thank you, committee.
Thank you. Well, we will take Mr. Wilson next, JL.
Thank you, Chair Burdick and members of the committee. I'm JL Wilson, representing Linn County in support of House Bill 2247. I'm just going to add a little depth on the policy discussion around the bill. Just some highlights that I want the committee to be aware of. First, as it's been alluded to, the bill is permissive. Counties can choose to forgive the interest or not. And I think one thing that should be said for context is that delinquent property taxes in the state are locked in at a 16% interest rate. And so really what we're talking about is giving the counties flexibility to waive that 16% in just one tax year. It would be the tax year starting on July 1, 2020 and extending through June 30th of this year. The bill has been narrowed down to just impact real property. Initially, we had considered personal property as well, but that is not the case in the bill before you. It is just real property. The bill is narrowed down to just apply to interest, as we alluded to, that 16%. Originally, we had talked about interest and penalties, but we're just talking about interest in this bill. The bill is narrowed down to apply only to property owners who are current on their taxes through February of 2020. And the reason we added that provision is to ensure that the chronic late payers weren't rewarded under this legislation, that in fact there was a bright line between who would be perhaps the beneficiary of this bill and those who were truly impacted. I think we're late enough now in the tax year that the only people for whom this bill would apply are those who are truly the intended recipients. And I want to make clear that the bill does not absolve the property owner from paying the back tax. We're just talking about the interest on that tax. And then finally, in terms of lost revenue to various jurisdictions in the state, there is a report required under this to report to the revenue officer to get a sense of the magnitude, but we think it's going to be relatively modest with respect to these forgiven interest provisions. The final thing that I'll I'll allude to here is that the provisions that would qualify you for this relief in the interest rate, your business would have had to have been closed down. You would have had to have demonstrated that you a portion of your rents were delinquent. You would have had to demonstrate also that your income with a certain percentage less than it was in a baseline year in 2020. And these are consistent with what a business owner would have had to show in order to get a PPP loan. And then the final provision that a taxpayer could meet is that it was a fire impacted property. So the bill, as the representative alluded to, was narrowed down significantly. We think it's a pretty narrow focus, but it does achieve what we set out to do, which was at least give the counties permission to adopt local ordinances to forgive interest on delinquent property taxes if, in fact, it could be shown that they were due to effects of the pandemic and wildfire. So with that, I will wrap up and happy to answer any of the policy questions.
Okay, thank you. Are there questions? Thank you very much. Next, we have three people from the Oregon Association of Broadcasters. I don't know whether all of them need to testify, but I will read the names and you can decide who needs to talk. So we have Zach Reeves, Bob Singer, and Matt McCormick.
Chair Burdick, we were signed up for House Bill 2331. I don't know if we have moved into that hearing yet or if we're still in the previous hearing.
We had a glitch here, so I will make a note of that. I was kind of wondering why you were signed up, but, you know, I'm always constantly surprised. So thank you. We will try to get to that one next. And also, Kingsley Kelly, were you also signed up for 2331 from KOBI?
He was.
He was. Okay. All right. Next, we have Seiji Shiratori from the Department of Revenue.
Madam Chair, I'm also signed up for 2331.
Okay. I think Tyler Jansen actually is signed up for this bill. Am I wrong?
That's correct, Chair Burdick. Chair Burdick, Vice Chair Boquist, members of the committee. For the record, Tyler Jansen here today on behalf of the Association of Oregon Counties. I just want to express strong support for House Bill 2247 and strong appreciation to Representative Bossart Davis for introducing the measure and for pulling together that work group that she described. In addition to the unanimous support that this measure enjoyed on the House side, I can also share that this was unanimously supported from AOC's Legislative Committee. I think it's a very important tool, which will provide counties just one more way to provide relief for those who suffered from wildfires or the pandemic. Happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Okay, we see no questions, and I believe we are at the end of this since I looked at the sign-up sheet for 2331, and it doesn't look like anybody on this bill is over there. So we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2247 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2331. And I see that we have Representative Marsh here. There she is. Welcome, Representative Marsh.
Thank you so much. Are you ready for me?
We're ready. Go ahead.
Chair Burdick and members of the committee, for the record, I'm Pam Marsh. I'm the House Representative for District 5. I just wanted to pop into your virtual room this afternoon with a couple of quick comments to affirm my support of House Bill 2331. I think there are a couple things I wanted to share. First, I think local broadcasters are distinctively different than other properties that are traditionally subject to central assessment. Broadcasters are in a single location. The services are provided on site. Typically, our centrally assessed properties have some sort of infrastructure in different places in the state. They are serving a much broader population in potentially in different locations. That's not the case for a local broadcaster who is really situated within a specific community. The second thought I wanted to share is my deep appreciation, hard earned, for the role of local broadcasters in our communities. I certainly will tell you, having experienced wildfire, our local broadcasters were critical for our ability to understand what was happening during the fire, for our ability to respond appropriately in emergency conditions, and then post-fire, for our understanding of what help was available, where people should go, and what we should be doing. Local broadcasters provide a tremendous service to our communities and to residents. And I think this is not a good time to impose more unknown burdens on them. So I am in support of House Bill 2331, passed through the House quite easily, and I hope you will view it positively as well. Thank you so much for the chance to talk.
Thank you. Are there questions? Okay, before we go to our next witnesses, we will have a description of the bill. We got a little out of order here.
Madam Chair Burdick, members of the committee, Jamie McGovern again. House Bill 2331, my apologies, is not a property tax exemption. What it does is it specifies that local over-the-air broadcasters would not be treated under the Department of Revenue central assessment. And therefore, they would still be assessed, but they would be assessed at the local level under the default property tax assessment approach that occurs for property that is not centrally assessed.
Okay, we had... Have we seen a similar bill? This sounds familiar. We seen a similar bill on this, or am I just thinking about a meeting I might have had on it?
Chris, I don't recall a similar bill, but I could be wrong.
I'm multi
affecting the broadcasters, affecting the central assessment of broadcasters.
No, this got confused a little bit with the broadcaster corporate income taxation bill. My guess is that may be what you're thinking of.
Yeah, and now I know, yeah. Okay, let's move to our witness list. We have three from the Association of Broadcasters, Zach Reeve, Bob Singer, and Matt McCormick. Did you want to start, Zach?
Yes, Senator Burdick, members of the committee. I'm Zach Reeves here today on behalf of the Oregon Association of Broadcasters. I will keep it very short. We appreciate you all considering this bill today, and I'll leave it for Matt and Bob, these certified smart folks, to fill you in on it a little bit.
Okay. Is Mr. McCormick next?
Okay. Good morning or afternoon. This is Matt McCormick from the law firm of Fletcher, Heald & Hildreth. I'm also counsel for the Oregon Association of Broadcasters. We thank you, Chairman Burdick and Vice Chairman Boquist and members of the committee for convening this hearing. This bill is important to broadcasters because it would put, if centrally assessed, they would be hit with a significant tax burden because of the addition of intangible property into the property to be assessed. Representative Marsh hit the main points about why we think we should not be included in the central assessment. What's happened as a result of a Oregon Supreme Court case defining the term data transmission services, there's some thinking that broadcast station, over-the-air broadcast stations, should be included in that definition. We don't think so for the reasons that were stated, that we are basically local businesses with a defined, relatively small geographical service area as opposed to a wide network of a service area like pipelines, telephone companies, et cetera. And for that reason, we are asking that what we think was an unintended consequence of the court case be reversed and that broadcast stations, over-the-air broadcast stations, remain locally assessed as they have been since since broadcasting came to Oregon almost 100 years ago. I will have written testimony that I will provide to the committee, and I'll be happy to answer any other questions that you might have.
Thank you. We'll take the third witness, and then we'll open up to questions for this panel. Bob Singer.
There we go. Good afternoon, Madam Chair Burdick and Vice Chair Boquist and members of the Finance and Revenue Committee. Thank you for scheduling this important hearing. I'm Bob Singer, Executive Director of the Oregon Association of Broadcasters. Previously served on the board for 7 years, Executive Director, and before that, General Manager of a family-owned group of TV stations in Bend, Oregon. I was first notified about central assessment of the broadcast stations about a year ago, alerted our members about the forthcoming changes, and the immediate response was very alarming, as you can imagine. Not only have our broadcast stations been under attack from the likes of Google and Facebook from an advertising standpoint, but COVID had forced many local businesses to shut down and curtail their marketing efforts, further affecting stations. The sole source of revenue for local radio is advertising, and in most cases, TV stations as well. Local broadcast stations are not as viable as they once were, and this added tax will be detrimental for their ability to cover the markets in which they're designated and obligated to serve according to the FCC guidelines. The additional tax burden of central assessment would impose would cause many of these stations to curtail their coverage. And in some cases, stations may no longer be feasible to even operate. The greatest concern I have for these small mom and pop stations, Burns, Astoria, John Day, where television isn't really covering their local markets. These are the stations that alert residents of fire dangers, dangerous road conditions, school lockdowns, et cetera. Comcast has no means to do this, only local broadcasters. I should add that Oregon is the only state in the country that is centrally assessing broadcast stations, only in Oregon. And we feel because, as Matt just said, this is an unintended consequence. Many stations have received their notifications of assessment. I've received lots of phone calls. And in some cases, the values have risen from 40% to almost 300%. We have cooperated with the Department of Revenue from the beginning. We work closely with them to actually craft the language of House Bill 2331. So the Oregon Association of Broadcasters encourage the approval of House Bill 2331 to keep our locally owned radio and TV stations viable so they can keep the local rural areas in which they serve informed and safe. Thank you very much for your time. And again, thank you for your hearing today.
Thank you. Are there questions for this panel? Okay, I see no questions. So we will move to Kingsley Kelly.
Oh, you know, thank you very much, Madam Chair Burdick, and the members of the Finance and Revenue Committee. I appreciate your making time to hear my comments, which I promise will be shorter than a commercial break. My name is Kingsley Kelly. I'm from KOBI in Southern Oregon. Representative Marsh's area as part of our coverage area. You know, we're locally owned stations that strive to serve our community. We do that with local news and programming, which we provide for free over the air without a subscription or any charges. During last year's devastating fires, we dedicated every resource we had to reporting what was happening and letting people know what they needed to do to be safe. In the case of the Alameda fire, several of our staff were directly affected, including one young man who worked on that coverage nonstop, knowing that his home was likely being destroyed, which unfortunately it was. In the aftermath of the fire, we focused on the recovery, from publicizing available resources to creating opportunities to help. You know, we're a small station in a smaller area of Oregon. We have a staff of 65 people who work and live here, and they made this possible. They also make it possible for us to do many other community-focused events and efforts every year. You know, an increased tax burden unintentionally leveled on stations like KOBI puts us at risk of not having the resources that we need to serve the community. And this is the same situation, as Bob said, that will be faced by many radio and TV stations across the state. So I ask you please to approve HB 2331 to allow KOBI, as well as other Oregon broadcasters, to continue to do our best in serving our community. Thank you.
Well, that was a very fine commercial. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Are there questions for Mr. Kingsley, Mr. Kelly? Okay, thank you very much. That completes our witness list, so we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2247 and open up a, on 2331. And open a public hearing on House Bill 2343.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, House Bill 2343B deals with enterprise zones. It permits the governing body of an enterprise zone to suspend the employment requirements under current statute required to receive the property tax exemption, or allow the participating entity to delay the property tax exemption and pay current taxes. And so this would be a permissive policy again. There is a dash four, and then the dash four really just changes the dates of applicability to match up with the pandemic. And you'll see the wording changing from property tax years to assessment years, but that aligns with the period of time for the pandemic as well.
Okay, thank you. Rocky Dallum.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, Rocky Dallum, appearing on behalf of the Oregon Economic Development Association. And that was a succinct summary of this bill, which is a relatively simple solution to a straightforward problem with a few technical glitches that we've worked throughout the session. First, want to just reiterate to some degree the urgency on this bill. We talked about this with some folks during the special session, but given the timing of tax years, would have to be a response this session. So essentially, enterprise zones, we won't go into great detail on those, but are designed to provide property tax incentives or property tax abatements for those employers who bring traded sector jobs. Those are jobs that have stickiness that are in, you know, sectors like manufacturing, where they're developing goods and services that are shipped outside of the state and globally in some cases. And really the idea of the enterprise zone is to get jobs in places in the state that don't have enough good jobs that are above the local wages and bring jobs that that are committed to be sustainable. During the pandemic, obviously, we had practitioners, whether those were local government folks or private economic development professionals, who realized that due to either the shutdowns, lack of access to supply chains, lack of access to markets, and now with the widely known workforce challenges, we're going to be unable to meet both the state statutory or their local employment agreement employment thresholds. and because of that would then be subject to property taxes that they hadn't paid or weren't expecting to pay, including in back tax years. So the solution is relatively simple. This and we wanted to keep it narrow. This would allow local governments to pass a resolution that would authorize their economic development professionals to work on an individual employer-by-employer basis to establish reasons that they couldn't meet those employment thresholds and then give a temporary break on them so that they wouldn't be required to pay the back property taxes that they were abated for the 3 to 5 years. I'll just mention quickly on the amendment, we have amended this bill twice. Partly because while it's a simple solution, just getting the technical components right for DOR, Business Oregon, and local assessors to make sure this is manageable on a relatively tight time frame has been a little bit of a challenge. But Ms. McGovern summarized the final amendment, which is to refer to the assessment year and move the dates up as opposed to the property tax year. That should give the clarity that we think the DOR and the assessors will need at the same time our local government's time to address those employers. So I know Mark Garst from League of Oregon Cities, who's done a lot of work and had a lot of conversations with all of the stakeholders, is also on to talk and answer questions. I'll also just note for those of you who I haven't talked to on the committee, we did make a few changes in conversations with AFL-CIO on the House side to make sure that the language was tight enough that this would only be used in these cases where it's in response to the pandemic, and no one beyond that will get a break from these employment requirements, which are important both from a state and a local level. So we hope the committee will support the amendments and the bill, and we can hopefully provide some relief to these employers around the state. Thank you.
Okay, and then I imagine that businesses vary in how long it'll take to recover their employment targets after the pandemic. So this gives the flexibility to maybe put a shorter deadline on one and a longer deadline on another one.
It will give that flexibility, and I'll let Mark answer that, but it also is still finite so that we ensure that it's within the periods. Because of the property tax years that it applies to, it won't be ad infinitum, so to speak. It will be within this and the next assessment year after we've changed the bill. So, you know, there could be long-term effects from the pandemic that we haven't anticipated yet. But it will be relatively narrow in its nature, and the local governments will have to be thinking about those resolutions before this becomes law at the end of September if we can get it passed. So it has some flexibility, but not so much flexibility that it's open-ended, and we're trying to thread a very narrow needle here between last year and the coming year.
Got it. Okay. Other questions from the committee? Thank you. Mark Garst.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, Mark Garst with the League of Oregon Cities. LOC strongly supports House Bill 2343, and we also support the B4 technical amendment that is really just in place there to make the county assessors' lives a little bit easier. Oregon has done very well, I think, with small businesses during the pandemic, getting out a lot of business support programs. I know cities have done a lot of programs on our own initiative using the coronavirus relief funds that we received. What we haven't done so well at is help for the traded sector businesses, those larger employers that are often the key to some of these communities being economically viable. Much like what we've seen private landlords do, where they've all across the state, where they've worked with tenants and they've tried to be flexible and think about forgiving rent when they've been able to, local governments want the ability to work with these companies. We recognize that they made a deal with us, but at the same time, we recognize that nobody anticipated that COVID was coming at the time that those agreements were signed. We do not take this matter lightly. One of the greatest benefits of this enterprise zone program, if you talk to any city leader, is employment for local members of the community, good jobs for the community. But at the same time, we do recognize that COVID has presented some unique challenges. A lot of these companies have had some of the issues that Rocky outlined, and that is at no fault of their own. We see this bill as just giving local governments that flexibility to work with these employers. You know, I think what it really comes down to is that cities really do not want to kick these folks when they're down. We know that these businesses are trying, and we would like to have the ability to work with them. I would ask for your support for House Bill 2343.
Thank you. Questions for Mr. Garst? See none. Thank you. Scott Brune.
Right. Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee. Good afternoon. My name is Scott Brune. I'm the Director of Tax and Fiscal Policy for Oregon Business and Industry. I get to be very quick here today, which is great. OBI is in strong support of House Bill 2343. For the reasons mentioned, we just believe this gives the local jurisdictions the option to give employers that have been impacted by COVID time to let those employers get their feet back on the ground. And we also believe that it protects the vitality and the strength of the enterprise zone concept and policies, a policy and a tool which we believe has just been one of the best job creating tools in the job creation tool set that Oregon has, and also one that we believe has created and sustains thousands of family wage jobs in Oregon. So I just want to encourage the committee to support this bill, and thank you, Madam Chair and Committee.
Thank you. Questions? I see no questions. Thank you. We will close the public hearing on House Bill 2343 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2781.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, House Bill 2781 cancels property taxes and interest on the port without a working waterfront with existing property tax delinquency since January 1st, 2012. Effectively, there seems to be two ports, which I think you'll hear about in Oregon, that for slightly different reasons have these long-term delinquent property tax amounts, and have not been paid, and the portions on them have not been paid. And under Oregon statute, without payment and certification of payment, there's restrictions on what can be done with that property.
Okay, we have Representative Brock Smith here. Welcome. Sure.
Thank you, Madam Chair, colleagues. State, for your record, State Representative David Brock Smith, House District 1 that encompasses part of the Port of Coos Bay and Charleston down to the Brookings Harbor, California border, over to West Cave Junction, up West I-5 to West Roseburg, and back over to the beautiful and largest city on the Oregon coast, Coos Bay, North Bend. This 2781 was brought to you by the Oregon Public Ports Association. The purpose of the bill is for those two ports, the International Port of Coos Bay and the Port of Tillamook Bay. In both cases, local assessors and tax collectors agree that all lawful efforts to collect the taxes on certain properties have been exhausted and the property taxes are uncollectible. One of the primary responsibilities of Oregon's ports is to spur economic development in their communities. And one of the primary ways to do that is to make land available for purchase or lease to private parties who develop those lands. However, with these property taxes that are owed, the county assessor is prohibited from recording a property transaction unless until all property taxes for that tax lot have been satisfied. And so this piece of legislation fixes those problems. And I'll leave it at that and let the chair call Mark Landauer, the director of the Oregon Public Ports Association.
Okay. Are there questions for Representative Brock Smith? Okay, we'll call Mark Landauer next.
Good afternoon, Chair Brodick, Vice Chair Boquist, and members of the committee. My name is Mark Landauer, and I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Public Ports Association. I'd like to thank you for taking the time today to hear House Bill 2781A, which was introduced at the request of our membership. Last summer, our association requested the drafting of this legislation that would authorize a process by which uncollectible property taxes could be canceled at the county level. The individual circumstances surrounding these cases will be explained just momentarily. And once we had a draft of that, we reached out to the county city's assessors to seek their feedback. And we listened very carefully to their concerns, and as a result of those discussions, we frankly replaced the entire bill. The amended bill that's before you today, as mentioned previously, addresses properties at two ports. Section one of the present bill addresses a property at the International Port of Coos Bay, and section two addresses a couple properties at the Port of Tillamook Bay, where a couple businesses went bankrupt and the owner is subsequently passed away. The assessors in each county have exhausted all methods of lawful collection for these properties, and that is why we are here before you today, because there is no statutory method by which a real property tax can be canceled. Michelle Bradley, who is the general manager of Tillamook Bay, was not able to join us today. So I'll just very briefly, if I may, describe the situation at the Port of Tillamook Bay, and I do have another witness waiting to discuss what is going on at the International Port of Coos Bay. The Port of Tillamook Bay has three tax lots comprising about 1,600 acres. Years ago, a taxable entity leased a portion of one of those large lots, about 400 acres. The individual was leasing a very small plot in that 400 acres. The individual ultimately went bankrupt and passed away. Years later, the port wanted to sell an acre that was within that same tax lot, but before the property could be transferred, all property taxes had to be satisfied within that tax lot. That development opportunity passed the Port of Tillamook Bay by because they would have had to pay that outstanding property tax due by a third-party individual. More recently, another tenant passed away and owed outstanding taxes on lease space. And now that the port is responsible for making the county assessment whole, and as you know, ports are non-taxable entities, ultimately the taxpayers of the port would likely end up having to pay those outstanding property taxes. So some of the challenges that are created due to these unpaid property taxes, Representative Brock Smith obviously mentioned one, is that you cannot transfer a property that has an outstanding property tax. It also creates an administrative burden, not only for the port itself, but for the assessors, because on an annual basis, as you know, 16% interest must be applied to those outstanding balances. And finally, from a public policy standpoint, as public bodies, we don't believe that our taxpayers should be held liable for a third party's outstanding real property tax liability. Passage of this measure will permit these two ports to explore the full range of options to put these properties back into productive use, thereby benefiting the state and local economies, generating new property and income taxes for both the counties and the state. Finally, we worked with very closely with assessors, including representatives from Tillamook and Coos County, and we know of no opposition. The measure did pass unanimously out of the House. And at this point, Madam Chair, I want to thank you, but I would also like to introduce Margaret Barber, the Internal and External Affairs Manager for the port, or for the International Port of Coos Bay. Thank you very much.
Thank you, and welcome, Margaret Barber.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Burdick, Vice Chair Boquist, and members of the committee. As Mark said, my name is Margaret Barber. I'm the Director of External Affairs and Business Development for the Port. It's my pleasure to be with you today to discuss HB 2781 and its importance to the Port of Coos Bay. This bill is intended to remedy an issue that arose in 1991 and persists to this day for us. So in 1991, the port entered into a lease agreement with the U.S. Coast Guard for port-owned property called the Citrus Dock. At that time, and until 2013, ORS 307.166 required that tax-exempt entities file an application for exemption. In what I'm sure was a simple oversight, the Coast Guard neglected to file the application until 1993. This resulted in a tax liability which remained unpaid by the Coast Guard. This tax liability was then transferred to the Port of Coos Bay when the lease concluded. As a result, with the tax interest that has accrued over the past 30 years, the current liability for the port has reached nearly $25,000. Coos County has indicated that they are statutorily unable to waive the tax or interest per ORS 311.785. Through discussions with the Oregon Department of Revenue, short of seeking a legislative change to the status, the port stuck with either paying everything or to have the taxes remain in place and continue to collect interest. Even though the Coast Guard would have been able or eligible for exemption in 1991 because they did not actually file until 1993, they are liable for taxes prior to when they were granted exemption. The Coast Guard did submit an appeal approximately 20 years ago, but they were not successful. We're respectfully requesting the legislature pass HB 2781 with the -1 amendments. It offers a common sense one-time fix for this specific tax liability and those at Port of Tillamook Bay. With the existing liability in place, as Mark said, the port's ability to effectively market this site to a new potential investor to promote economic development is significantly reduced. I want to thank you for your time and happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? And to if you're still there, Mr. Landauer, the situation with the Tillamook port, how did they accumulate their liability?
Again, Madam Chair, Mark Landauer for the record. Madam Chair, the two outstanding property taxes are due to a privately leased portion of the port property by private individuals. Both individuals went bankrupt and both individuals have subsequently died. Those property taxes were accrued prior to, and it's spelled out, I believe, in the bill, I think it's June 1 of 2012, if my memory is serving me correctly. I don't have the bill right in front of me, but it also distinguishes it purely at the Port of Tillamook Bay because they happen to be the only port in the state that does not have a working waterfront. And if I may just add one last thing, Madam Chair, Ms. Barber mentioned the -1 amendment. That amendment is no longer needed. We actually, the House adopted a -2 amendment, which addressed the problem. So the bill, at least in its present form, is the bill that we believe, of course, if it has the support of the committee, can move forward. Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions from the committee? Okay, thank you. We will close the public hearing on House Bill 2781 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3275.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, House Bill 3275B is a bill that would provide property tax exemption for properties that are burdened by affordability covenants. And so there's, for residential properties, there's a property tax exemption. And then for condos, the property tax exemption on this would be 27% of the value. And these are for low income housing and but for particularly low-income housing that is owned, but the land underneath the property is not owned by the individual. These are community land trust properties, and so that the land remains in the ownership of the community land trust, and the individual can, purchase and own the home.
Thank you. Representative Pham is here to testify on this, I believe. Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Burdick and Vice Chair Boquist and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Khan Pham. I'm the state representative for House District 46, and I'm honored here to testify in support of House Bill 3275B. So as we know right now across Oregon, families are currently living in rental housing and they're ready to take the next step, but they can't move out of their rental units because there just aren't enough affordable homes on the market for low and moderate income families. For years, we've been seeing housing prices skyrocket in Bend. As you know, the median home price is $515,000. Similarly, in Portland, it's over $500,000. And this is a statewide problem that requires innovative statewide solutions, including using our tax system to support families achieve their dream of home ownership. So in the community land trust model, a nonprofit organization owns the land underneath the homes, and the home buyer owns just the house on top of it. The nonprofit sells the home on top of the land to a low-income buyer for a reduced sales price. And this opens the door to first-time home ownership for home buyers who would otherwise be priced out of the housing market. So the problem which this bill is trying to address is that currently owners of community land trust homes have to pay for the property tax on the assessed value of both the house and the land, even though they do not own the land and are restricted on what they can sell the house for because there's an affordability covenant, a 99-year affordability covenant. House Bill 3275B would institute fair taxation of these permanently affordable homes by ensuring that homeowners of community land trust homes get a partial exemption on their property taxes to reflect that while they do need to pay the taxes on their home that they own, they shouldn't also have to pay taxes on the land that they don't own. We've engaged with a broad group of stakeholders to strengthen this bill, including the Department of Revenue, county assessors, county commissioners, AOC, and homeowners. And in particular, we are grateful for the productive conversations with county assessors to ensure smooth implementation of the changes proposed in this bill. Their feedback helped to clarify the process for claiming exemptions that we've incorporated in the Dash 4 amendment. I firmly believe that we should seek to address our housing crisis while also laying the groundwork for home ownership. This partial property tax exemption is an effective and necessary tool to incentivize and support more permanently affordable home ownership opportunities at a time when Oregon urgently needs them. Therefore, I urge your support for House Bill 3275B, and I'm happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. So what is the status of the land? Would the land under this bill, would the land be tax-free, or would the organization pay the taxes on the land? What would the status be?
Yes, thank you, Chair Burdick. Under the community land trust model, a nonprofit owns the land trust, and so they don't have to pay property taxes on the land as well. That's my understanding.
Okay, it's kind of surprising that it ever was taxed if the ownership was in a nonprofit. That's
Well, under the community land trust model, the homeowner actually does own their home, right. but they're under a 99-year affordability covenant, and it's under a shared equity model. Usually these community land trusts have a shared equity model where they recognize that they gain some level of equity, but it's not the full 100% of equity that they would gain in a normal homeownership, recognizing that the nonprofit then takes some of that equity to maintain affordability so that the next homeowner, when that family's ready to move on, they can keep this house permanently affordable. Because currently we have this problem where we may give some subsidies for one family to own the home, but then unless we really keep ownership of the land, we also have some covenants to keep the land affordable, we lose that to the market later. So that's why this community land trust model is so important to keeping the supply of affordable housing more stable and keep it permanently affordable for the next family.
Okay, thank you. We have, are there questions for Representative Pham? Thank you very much. We have three people from Proud Ground, Diane Lynn, Katie Ulrich, and Kristen Carter. How do you want to arrange yourselves here? Okay, I'll go in order. Is Diane Lynn?
Hello, Senator Burke. This is Diane Lynn. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Awesome. Thank you, Chair Jay Burdick, Vice Chair Boquist, and the members of the Finance and Revenue Committee of the Senate. A very special thank you to Representative Khan Phan, who has been our chief sponsor and champion for this bill, for her leadership and service. My name is Diane Lynn. I'm Executive Director of Proud Ground. We're a 501c3 nonprofit that serves families in Multnomah County, Washington, Clackamas, Lincoln County, and Clark County, Washington. We create permanently affordable homeownership opportunities for first-time homebuyers through education, counseling, housing development, asset management, and using the model, as Representative Fahn described, Prog Ground has ensured more than 375 homes remain permanently affordable, and we've been able to serve over 550 families in the greater Portland area and Lincoln County, receiving the wonderful stabilization that homeownership can provide to working families. Chair Burdick, I think you asked a very important question, which is how is a nonprofit that owns the land ever charged for taxation? And this is something this bill will simply codify. The practice is being already used in Multnomah, Clackamas, and Washington counties because they have recognized that the land is held by a nonprofit and should not be charged to the homeowner. This bill is very important to our organization because it impacts the families that work so hard to earn this opportunity, and it affects their monthly costs. There's one county in our service area, Lincoln County, and sadly, County Commissioner Claire Hall cannot be with us today, but she is on our board and has been working with us to try to apply this discounted fair housing to shared equity homeowners in Lincoln County. And, you know, the assessors have been concerned and wanted to kind of clarify and have the state really establish the gold standard on this. And as Rep. Fahn mentioned, we've been in communication with the assessors and the revenue folks and other people to be sure this is dialed in just right through the amendments we worked on so hard on the Senate side. So it is just simply a fair taxation proposition, public policy that holds the land that we hold as a nonprofit off the tax rolls, as is a practice statewide, and really protects the homeowners and the amount they have to pay monthly. And that's very important to people that make, on average, 60% of median income, because they only have a certain amount of money to work with. And this bill will not just affect Prog Ground, but will affect Habitat for Humanities around the state and other agencies, including shared equity co-ops and other entities. It's not just about us. It's just about the people that live in these units. And as we hope to grow these units into the future to serve more families and close the really egregious racial disparity gap in homeownership, we hope this will help even more families down the road. It's a wonderful opportunity to codify a really important practice and to establish it as a statewide practice. Happy to answer more questions, although we've got two people following me that are also wonderful resources.
Okay, thank you. We do have two more people. I would ask you to keep your comments very brief because we are just about out of time and there's one more item we need to discuss. So we'll start with Katie Ulrich, if you could keep your comments within a couple minutes.
Can you hear me? This is Katie.
Yes.
I think I will just stand by for answering questions because Rep. Fahn and Diane really covered everything I was going to say.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Kristen Carter.
Hi. Can everyone hear me?
Yes.
Okay. Hello, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Kristen, and I am a Prog Ground board member and a Prog Ground homeowner for 10 years. And I just briefly wanted to share the impact on my family that homeownership has created for us. I come from a very long line of generational poverty. I was on Section 8 and struggling when I first came in contact with Prog Ground. Through a lot of support, I was able to become a first-time homeowner, actually the first homeowner in at least four generations. We are a BIPOC family that also lives with multiple disabilities. The stability of homeownership not only kept us from panicking during the COVID epidemic and knowing that we had a home, an affordable home, kept us stable, and that allowed us to become active in our local community. My children were able to continuously access their necessary therapy. And my eldest son graduated from college early as valedictorian. And I attribute that to being able to have the stability of a solid home, not moving from neighborhood to neighborhood, and the affordability of that home. And now he's a college student. So I just wanted to thank everybody for listening. And that's just a brief rundown.
I appreciate it very much, and good luck to you and your son.
Thank you.
You must be very proud.
Thank you.
Are there questions for either of these witnesses? Okay, thank you very much. We will close the public hearing on House Bill 3275 and return to our work session on Senate Bill 139. There's some information that our wonderful staff has prepared for us to hear today. So, Chris.
Thank you, Madam Chair. While Kyle's coming online, I would point out there is a dash 13 and dash 14 amendments. Okay. And there's Kyle. So I'm just gonna hand it off to Kyle. He's gonna walk through an example.
Welcome, Kyle. Thank you. We're looking forward to your report.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee, Kyle Easton, Legislative Revenue Office. And yes, as Chris was saying, we have the dash 13 and the dash 14. So the dash 13 amendment to Senate Bill 139 is picking up on with the discussion that the committee has had related to the Oregon's reduced rates for pass-through entities. So the dash 13 is building off of what was the dash 7 the committee heard just a couple of days ago. But just to go over quickly some of the changes that are in the dash 13 that's changed since the last time this committee heard this policy proposal. The first is relating to some of the smaller businesses by profit amount. So those business entities, these are partnerships or S-corps that have less than $250,000 in ordinary business income, also known as profit, they would not be held up. The new changes being proposed in 139 would not apply to those smaller businesses with under $250,000 in profit. So they would still have to continue to meet the existing law requirements to receive the reduced rates when that income's passed through, but they wouldn't be subject to this new change related to the employed-employer ratio that's being proposed and or the reinvestment requirement. So it's more or less moving aside some of those smaller businesses from these new requirements to be met. The other change, and the committee heard some feedback on this in the public hearing, was related to the ratio of Oregon employees to Oregon owners. That has been changed so that the employees are, they don't have to be Oregon residents, but they are employees doing work here in Oregon. And then the ratio to the owners of the pass-through is now all of the owners. It's not specific to an Oregon resident owner. So there was some concern about using Oregon owners only, Oregon resident owners only. And then there's also some language modifying that ratio requirement to try to make that fit better with the existing law requirements and the aggregate hours of 1,200 and everything. So that was working with LC to get that language tightened up to more closely align with the way the policy has been described of the number of employees, the number of owners in the entities. But so that's the dash 13. The dash 14
Kyle, before you move to the 14, it would not change the fact that if you have an out-of-state owner, they would still have to be materially participating in the business. Is that correct?
Absolutely, Madam Chair. Yes, that's correct.
So this wouldn't apply to passive owners.
In terms of benefiting from these reduced rates, you do have to be non-passive income and material participation. For the ratio itself, it's just specifying employees to owners. So it doesn't delineate in that case if you're an out-of-state owner, whether you're a passive investor or an active.
Got it. But you don't get the lower rates unless you're an active owner.
Right. Yes. It's just for the ratio. Yeah.
Okay.
So those are the dash 13. The dash 14 amendment is the contents of the dash 13 plus the language that the committee's heard about relating to really this a policy to try to mitigate the state and local tax deduction limitations put in place at the federal level a couple years ago. we're continuing to refine some of that language again, and Chris can speak more to the specifics, but this language was originally was built upon some language that came from New Jersey, which is one of the few other states that have done this policy, but we're continuing to work with that to refine it to make it fit more with Oregon, Oregon tax law as well. And then there's also some other things, I don't know if we have time today, if Chris wants to mention them, or we can pick them up at a later point, the specifics.
Yeah, we've got time for a few specifics if you want to, Chris.
Sure, Madam Chair. So a couple of the things, there's the definition of pass-through entity, and a lot of these are modifications. Some of them touch on policy meant to clarify. And try to learn from some of the experience from New Jersey and avoid some of the problems they're having. The pass-through entity definition is changed to clarify that it includes an LLC that would be electing to be treated as a partnership or S corporation. And one point of contention, potential contention, in Section 5, it talks about all members of the pass-through entity are individuals subject to the personal income tax imposed under Chapter 316, that's the individual income tax. One of the questions here is, for this policy, what kind of, the pass-through entities can be very complicated, multi-tiered entities. So there's a decision as to how complicated you want them to be. You can have corporations that are part of these entities that are a partner. You can have a partnership between an individual and a C corporation, and it can get pretty complicated. So part of the intent here was to go as an initial step to modify that a little bit. So that would be a point of talking about where to draw that line and how complicated the entity can be, whether it just needs to be made up of individuals or can it include some other entities that might have as themselves individuals or other entities.
Okay. Senator Boquist has his hands up. I may have missed him before. So, Senator Boquist.
Well, I'd like Chris to kind of continue that because I'm trying to understand and maybe use an example to explain it to the committee so we all understand. I mean, if you had an LLC, we'll say an example, and this is not untypical, and it had three individuals, and then the fourth partner was actually another LLC. Would the three individuals still qualify, or do all of the individuals of the LLC or the S-Corp has to be an individual? And this is that area where Chris is trying to qualify. So maybe you can explain it just a little bit more, Chris, and what some variance might be for us.
Sure. So let's say you have an LLC with three members. The simplest model would be that those are three individuals and those individuals pay the personal income tax. That would be the simplest model. But you can also have a tiered entity where you have those three individuals and maybe that fourth entity is even a C corporation or an S corporation or another partnership or another LLC. And so you can have three individuals and an LLC being the four members of an LLC or a partnership. Now you have that LLC, which is one of those members. Now, what kinds of entities make up that LLC? That LLC can be made up of two individuals or two other partnerships. So the question here is what kind of sideboards does the committee want to put on this policy? The way the Dash 14 is drafted right now is that all of the members need to be individuals. You could certainly extend it so that if every member of a given entity is either an individual or another entity that is made up of only individuals. Part of the original thinking was, let me stop right there to see if that makes sense before I go any further.
Senator Boquist?
Yeah, it does. And what we're really saying here is that the intent of the policy, how you get to write in there, as you point out, must be the issue in some of these other 14 states or so, is that if you have three individuals that are, just hypothetically, they make $100,000, you have the pass-through, there's four members of the LLC,
Three of them are individuals. That's $25,000 each. And this, and the fourth one turns out to be another S-Corp or LLC. As long as they were an S-Corp or LLC, that pass-through percentage would still go to an individual and be on a pass-through. What gets complicated, I think you're saying, is what happens is it's a C corporation, and then under the present drafting, are we assuming then that the entity, the value of the pass-through, it would just be their portion of the pass-through that would count? Am I making sense here, Chris?
Absolutely, and those are the right things we want to clarify, make sure we have nailed down for the intent of the committee. Part of the original thinking was, well, you can have a C-Corp that's embedded in here. They're not going to be interested in paying this new tax because they don't get the tax credit. The tax credit is only available to individuals or trusts, those entities that pay the individual income tax. And as we were thinking about this and exploring what other states have done and talking to DOR, it seemed to make sense to draw some line here at the onset of limiting how complex the entities can be that are eligible for this. So in some ways, the way this version is drafted is that they have to be as simple as possible. In other words, only individuals. But that is an open question for the committee. Well, maybe you want to take it one step further and allow an entity to be a partner that is itself made up of only individuals. And kind of the idea is just keeping C-Corps out of the equation altogether and minimizing the complexity, both for the taxpayers as well as the Department of Revenue.
Yeah, my inclination would be to keep it simple. I mean, we're not going to be able to help everyone with this, including me, because I'm not an S corporation. I mean, it's by nature, it's already limited. And this is new ground we're plowing here. And so my inclination would be to keep it as simple as possible, but I'd be very eager to hear what other members of the committee think. Senator Boquist?
Well, Madam Chair, I mean, if you write it as it only applies to the individuals, as the individual applies to the entity, that's the Swiss cheese Chris and Kyle are working on here is we're targeting individuals only, but if the pass through is going to the individual anyway, the question is how do you get that? If it turns out to be there's an LLC or something in there and it's still going to the individual, I mean, keep it simple, stupid, and figure out how to pass it through. And I guess that's really some LRO, you know, brainstorming on how to make it and keep it simple doing it that way.
Okay. And another layer to that is you have an entity that consists of four owners, partners. Is it all or nothing? Do all four members, so running with an example of four members, four owners, is the requirement that all four of them have to participate in paying the alternative tax and then getting the tax credit? Or do you want to allow a subset of the owners? Say you only want to allow three owners to participate. And again, that's where we've gone. The current language is that KISS example that Senator Boquist just referred to is, no, it's everybody or nobody. But those are policy decisions for the committee.
How complicated would it be to have it if you had three of the four owners want it? Because the problem we have here is that we are imposing a new tax on people, and I don't want to get caught up in the the optics of that unless we can be very clear about the offset. And so how complicated would it be if you have multiple owners? They're all passed through, but not all of them want to do this. How complicated would that be?
It might be more complicated for the taxpayers. I mean, and that's where I'm looking for input from entities. I mean, on the Department of Revenue standpoint, so from the state side, I'm not sure it's that complicated. I think it might be more so for the taxpayer. Mm-hmm. And if it's too complicated for the taxpayer, my guess is that they wouldn't participate. It's like, well, mm-hmm. But again, that's where starting off as simple as possible. I mean, this is a complex area, but starting off as simple, that's where the language currently structured is individuals only. but there is some decision. There are some decision points here.
Senator Finley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I understand the rationale more than likely for moving from the -7 to the -13 and the -10 to the -14, because certainly residency requirements is problematic legally. And I understand the concepts, of the pastors. I look at the calendar, I see that it's June 9th. And this is not ready for prime time action, in my belief. And I certainly think about the statement you just made, Madam Chair, that this is a new tax and it needs properly vetted. So I guess I'm just holding up a yellow flag that's saying, holy smoke, this is a big deal, and it's June 9th. So I'm just careful that we don't want to do something that one, can't pass a red face test, and two, is legal to do. And the hill's pretty darn high at this point. So I appreciate the 13 and the 14. I thought there were some significant components with the residency requirements. And so, yeah, I just, this is somewhat troubling, Madam Chair. So thank you.
Now, are you talking about there are really two components. There's the pass-through reform, and then there's the SALT issue. You're talking about both of those or just one? You're on mute.
Well, yes, I was. Thank you. I love the SALT issue. I mean, I love the base component of this because I think the SALT issue is a good thing. And the other is the non-SALT component of this bill is problematic at some point. So
okay, Senator Boquist.
Chris, could you? What you're trying to do is what we're trying to weed through here, and I believe there's 14. There's New Jersey is kind of the model, and there's 14 other states. Are the other states simply, for example, just say? Are they saying, yeah, it's got to be a pass-through entity period, which means it's either an S-corp or an LLC-LLP, meaning it's individuals in the end. How did they structure those in the other states? Are you aware of that? Because, throwing the C-corporations out of a pass-through bill makes perfect sense. It's just the way it works out because the C-corporations aren't pass-throughs, which makes it easier. But how did their wording, because you were trying to LRO, working with DRR is trying to come up with wording to better language than what the other states have done. So what are those other states doing?
Senator Boquist, I'll have to do a little more digging to get a full answer to that one. Kyle can't tell, but I'm looking at him to see if he happens to have an answer on any of the other states. I don't think we have. We've kind of focused on New Jersey since that's where the language started, but we will dig into those other states, but it kind of became clear that in terms of keeping it as simple as possible, staying in the world of just individuals was at least a starting point for cleaning up the language that we have before us. But we'll do a little more digging to find out if there are other solutions employed by other states.
And Madam Chair, just as a follow-up, I know we've got to have some research here because Senator Haas worked at this, and I was still on the committee when Senator Haas was there, and Senator Riley was there when we were working on all these SALT issues after the initial federal tax package, which seems like eons ago, but I think it was only 2 years ago, but whatever it was.
Yeah, and I believe the whole pass-through issue has, you did a considerable amount of work on that in previous sessions as well, so... It is not as, this has been an evolving process to get to this point, to get to the -13 amendment, Senator Finley. Okay, thank you very much. It's been very helpful. We'll probably be scheduling this for another public hearing on the -13 and 14. So I'll be conferring with Senator Boquist on how to proceed. So thank you, LRO staff. And Chris, do we have anything else we need to accomplish here?
I don't think so. Let me take a look back at the agenda. I think you've gone through, you've carried over. Well, it doesn't matter if you carry them over because of the change of the rules, but I think we'll be posting for Monday sometime soon.
Good. And we've got two tax joint tax credit tax expenditure meetings coming up. Tomorrow we meet at 5:30. Is that right, Chris?
That's correct. 5:30 tomorrow and then 3:15 on Friday.
Right. And we've got a very ambitious agenda. If we could get through it, we all get a prize and an ice cream cone. But realistically speaking, it will probably go beyond Friday. So, okay, with that, we are adjourned.
Thank you, Madam Chair.